This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. I'd like to thank our sponsors who make our podcast possible. First, Iberia Bank and First Horizon, who are now one bank. Two relationship-driven banks, both leaders in the industry, have officially joined forces. The combination of Iberia Bank and First Horizon creates a leading financial services company dedicated to enriching the lives of their clients, associates, and their communities. I'd also like to thank Lafayette General Health, who has joined the Ochsner Health family and is now Ochsner Lafayette General. As one health system, Ochsner Lafayette General will provide expanded services and enhanced care from the familiar faces you already trust. Ochsner Lafayette General means more resources to help solve healthcare's toughest problems, reinvesting in our communities, and being further committed to health and wellness. Ochsner Lafayette General. Together means more. Learn more today at togethermeansmore.org. Today's guest is Dr. Shonda Grisby, a general surgeon who is fellowship trained in breast surgical oncology with advanced skills in treatment of breast diseases. She specializes in surgical techniques for the treatment of benign and malignant breast diseases, as well as patients at high risk for breast cancer. She is with Ochsner Lafayette General. Dr. Grisby is joining us during Breast Cancer Awareness Month, a yearly event held each October to increase awareness of the disease. Dr. Grisby was recently honored as a 2020 Spirit of Hope honoree by the American Cancer Society in recognition of her work to increase breast health. Originally from North California, Dr. Grisby earned a Doctor of Medicine from the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. She recently joined the Acadiana community from Michigan, where she completed a fellowship in breast surgical oncology. According to the CDC, breast cancer is the most common cancer in women, aside from some types of skin cancer, no matter the race or ethnicity. Unfortunately, Louisiana is ranked number 3 in breast cancer mortality. Information is powerful, and we're fortunate to have an expert with us today to share the latest on breast cancer and the advancements in the field. Dr. Shonda Grisby, thank you for joining us on Discover Lafayette.
All right, my pleasure.
Yeah, so we're here early in the morning, and you can hear the birds singing outside of my window. We're on Zoom.
Yep, it's definitely early.
You're very kind to take time out of your day. I understand your days are packed from way before sunup to way past sundown.
Yes.
Yeah, welcome.
Definitely very busy.
Yeah.
But, I'm happy to be here. And again, like you said before, my goal is to just be aware, to make people aware.
Yeah.
And so I'm happy to be here.
So you joined our community in 2017, if I understand it right, and kind of jumped right in.
I very much did, actually. When I first got here, I wanted to introduce myself to the community and let people know that I was around. And my ultimate goal was just to allow people to know that breast disease is a big deal. As you pointed out, in Louisiana, it's one of the top three areas where mortality rate was highest. And that's part of the reason why I ended up in Louisiana. People always ask me, oh, you're from California, how'd you end up here? And really, my family's from Louisiana originally. My parents were from the north of Shreveport and Monroe area. When I was looking for areas to go after I completed my fellowship, my ultimate goal was to take all the knowledge that I had gained and bring it to a place or a space where I felt like it was going to be utilized. When I looked around at different communities I had family who lived here, it piqued my interest. I looked into the state statistics and things, and I said, okay, well, I think I might be able to do some good. And came down here to interview, and of course the culture took hold, I guess, of me right away. Even when I was on my plane trip down for an interview, I think that the hospital system has been very supportive. Their ultimate goal was my ultimate goal, and I think that was a big driving force for me, because you really need that support from the community and from the hospital system where you work to really put out messages of good health. That's essentially what brought me down to this area, and then I've been moving ever since.
I'd like you to share what motivated you to go into medicine at the beginning. I know that you have a personal story that touched your heart, but I think it's interesting. You're empowering for other women to hear. You're in a highly specialized field, and this took forever for you to get your degree and your residency requirements and all. But what was the original impetus for you to go into medicine?
So actually, medicine in general, one day I woke up when I was in my, you know, early childhood and said, I'm going to be a doctor. So that's just, I didn't have any exposure, I guess, to it. But I just said one day, I'm not sure what I saw or what what piqued that interest. But as I got into parts of my life, I actually spent time with several people in my community growing up. And when I said I wanted to be a doctor, so I actually spent time with, I thought I want to be an anesthesiologist. I don't want to do, there's several different things, and got exposures to those while I was in high school. But then what really kind of piqued me, my antenna, should I say, is a friend's sister was just completed law school and found a breast lump, and she didn't live very long. And that was, I think, very shocking to like all of us. And, you know, I was young and I was still learning about life at that time, but I thought, wow, it was very much, you know, she, in her early 30s, very much like, you know, she was about to hit her prime and just done all this hard work. And then you're hit with a bombshell such as that. It was very enlightening for me. And then I segue into surgery over time, because I feel like I had a artistic mindset, I guess. And that's kind of how I think about surgery, I guess, in general. For me, I like to draw, I like to paint and that do stuff with my hands. And so that's really what segued me down the surgery path, I think. And then as medical student in the combined program of Charles R. Drew and David Geffen School of Medicine. And that program was meant to foster development of physicians who wanted to go out into the communities that had low either socioeconomic status or burdens of disease that were difficult, or the community was difficult, should I say, in urban areas. And so that fostering it together made me kind of, I guess, partly who I am and why I'm even coming down to a place where I feel like I can do good, because that's kind of just been my role or my path. And then when I got into my residency for general surgery, I got even more honed into breast. Then, you know, I have made friends from all kinds, and I, you know, nursing staff, and one of the nursing staff that I was really close with found a lump, and I went through her whole process with her. I went through the biopsies with her. I went through her surgical consultations with our attendings at the time, did her surgery. I mean, the whole process. And today she's still cancer-free, and today we still have many conversations about just life and checking on one another. And that is just the person that I feel like I am. And I think when it comes to taking care of patients with breast issues, not just breast cancer, but it's very high anxiety provoking. And I feel it takes a personality to really truly try to make someone feel comfortable, even when it's not going to end up okay, I guess. But, and so I felt like I had that personality. And ever since then, I kind of just hit the ground running with getting experiences. I rotated at Sloan Kettering and during my residency program, because my residency program was in a smaller area of Pennsylvania, and we didn't have everything all together. We had a lot of breast disease, and I did a lot of breast surgery, but getting a program together and how that structure should look and what that looks like, that's what led me to go do a 2-month rotation in Sloan Kettering. And of course, they're a powerhouse of breast at Sloan Kettering in New York City. And so that just also kind of culminated to, okay, I need to do this fellowship. I need to make sure that I have these other things, you know, and that's just essentially how that line of process is gone. And I'm blessed. All my experiences have been leading me to this point, I think.
So I have a question. I looked up, you know, how do you become a surgical oncologist? Would you explain the number of years? Like, you don't just go to medical school, and it's not just a residency. This is an arduous process to get where you are. Would you explain the years? And
yeah. So obviously a medical school is usually 4 years. And then following that, you usually go into a general surgery residency, and a general surgery residency can be anywhere between 5 years to 7 years. And that's just depending on if you take years off for research or what have you. So 6 years is what I did for jaw surgery. And then I did an additional year just focused on breast surgical oncology. There is surgical oncology general, which is 2 years because they're doing everything surgical oncology. But I clearly wanted to focus on breast. So I took the breast route and did a year dedicated to that. And during that year, you are rotating with various different breast surgeons. You also are rotating with radiology. You spend time going through radiology yourself, going through the biopsies, the mammogram imaging, so you become well-versed in looking at imaging. And again, I did a lot of that already, but it was just some more to solidify that. We also spent time in the pathology labs, grossing specimens, looking at things, so we know that process very well. Spent time in radiation oncology, looking at how that process goes. So that's, you know, how can I explain that to a patient before they get there? That's why I'm able to do that, because I've sat in those spaces, I've done those consultations, I've done all the steps that a radiation oncologist would have taken. And then we also rotate with medical oncology as well. And so we learn a lot about the chemotherapy, the side effects, those issues, risk benefits, the hormone blockers, as I call them, or endocrine therapy, all that stuff, you know, how to manage bone disease and bone health, like all that was encompassed in my fellowship, which to me made me a very well-rounded. And of course, we did a lot of plastics, and I did a lot of breast and plastics during my entire surgical training. Okay. So I learned both of those. I learned pretty much all aspects of breast, as you know, flaps, all that kind of stuff. Do I do all the plastics now? No, but I do have a vast knowledge in that. And I think that has helped me to navigate patients through a process where I'm able to kind of give them a little bit of an explanation of how that looks, or what it looks like, or what to expect when they're making decisions about treatments, because that's really the biggest point, is you're making decisions based off of some what ifs a little bit, and how do you, you know, coax them through those what ifs. And that's still a learning process for me, actually, because I find that it's such a abundance of knowledge that someone's getting at one time. It could be very, very...
They probably don't hear most of what the doctors are telling them. Would you walk us through, who is your typical patient, if you have one? How do people find their way to Ochsner, Lafayette General, and Dr. Grisby? Like, is this typically through their GPs? Like, what happens? How do people end up with you?
So let's say if it's somebody who's getting their screening mammograms regularly, they can either present to the Ochsner, Lafayette General Breast Center, the surrounding breast centers, like Breast Center of Acadiana and the other ones in the community. And what happens is our radiologists are all fellowship trained as well, similar to myself, where they've done dedicated time outside of their general radiology training, specifically reading breast. And so that's what I think gives these type of institutions an advantage, is that that's all the radiologists are doing. So they are looking at mammograms day in and day out. And then if they find something, generally what happens is that the radiologist will call a patient back, and we try to give them a heads up, explain them why we're calling them back, and do additional imaging. So a screening mammogram is usually meant just to screen. We're not going into like dive into anything. We're looking to see if there's something to dive into. And so when they come back, they're getting something called a diagnostic workup now, because now we're trying to see if there's something to diagnose. And so therefore we're going to do much more, you know, comprehensive, intensely looking at a particular spot or what have you, could include an ultrasound, things like that. And then usually what happens is that if there's any indication or need for a biopsy, the breast radiologists here are really good at bringing the patient in, discussing their imaging, let them know what they're seeing and why they're recommending a biopsy, scheduling that biopsy if it needs to be done. And then once the biopsy is done, it takes a couple of days for that result to come back. And our radiologists are really invested in, we're a team. So what they try to do is make sure they give them, and they speak to them about their past results before they come to see me. So they're a little bit aware, and I'm not the first person telling them, although that's also happened. And so then once they come to me, it's more of a process of kind of going through it and making sure they understand what it is that they have been diagnosed with. That's usually my biggest point, is I want them to understand it at least enough to be able to tell somebody else about it. Because what happens when they get out of here, someone asks them, like, so what happens? What they say? And it's like, they've gotten a slew of information. So I usually tell people a very, I try to bring it down to a level where I think that they can tell a story. I try to tell it in a story. And so I would say, okay, you have these, you know, milk ducts, grape factories, like a grape, and it has these big vines, but the vines are like a plumbing system. And so you can tell people that you have cancer, but it hasn't sprung a leak. It's in the plumbing system. That's considered a non-invasive, right? But mm-hmm. if it springs a leak, then you get a little puddle, and that's what we see, you know? And so now you have what we call an invasive cancer, because now you have a little puddle in the breast that it looks like a little mass. And so that's kind of how I explain it. So that way when someone's explaining to somebody else, it comes across in a way that it's understandable. So that's my role. And then obviously breaking down their options. And that's really when things get a little bit trickier, because now there's still some what is on the table for patients sometimes. So like you asked me what type of patient comes. It's usually somebody who has not felt anything, who did not expect to have an abnormal mammogram. That's the usual patient that I see. And so when it wasn't like they were prompted because there was something going on in their body. So they are still in relative shock a lot of the times. So that's when I try to make sure that they are aware of what's going on. And most people, what we catch thankfully here, are really early stages. So like early, stage ones, stage twos, small, you know, relatively no issues with the lymph nodes at the time on at least initial imaging or clinical exam. But essentially, it's my role at that point is just trying to get them to understand where they are, what their stage is, what options exist. And then from those options, giving them the risk and benefits of, you know, surgery at that point. But I kind of give them a little bit of a heads up of these are still questions and outliers. We need to do surgery first. There are occasions, obviously, where people have come later on and they have had a mass they felt, or and it's not necessarily later on, because sometimes you'll find that some cancers can grow a little faster, right? So you'll have had a normal mammogram 6 months ago, but now you feel something. So then, they prompt a workup, and you start off with a diagnostic thing. You're not really screening anymore because there's actually a problem or there's actually a concern. And so that's what I try to go out into the community and teach, is that if you feel something, see something, something's changed, not normal to you, then you need to bring it to somebody's attention and do not wait for your scheduled screening, because it's not a screening anymore. There's a problem. And we need to, and I usually do a shout back. We need to do what? A diagnostic. What? And that's how I teach it to the community, because I want them to ingrain it in their mind that there's a problem. It needs to be a diagnostic workup, and you're not waiting for your screening mammogram to happen in 3 months if it's already scheduled.
So you manage breast cancer care, and not all of your patients end up having surgery. I know you're a surgical oncologist, but you manage care once people present with breast cancer.
Correct. So sometimes, you know, it gets to the point where surgery is not necessarily the first step. It may be a part of the process, but it's not always the first step. But they usually come to me first so we can kind of talk about I do a lot of the explaining of what their cancer is. And so then I say, okay, these are the ways we can go. I usually have a nice diagram or a spreadsheet. I do a lot of drawing. I have I purposely created a whiteboard wall in the consult room that we use. I do a lot of drawing because I think drawing, one, helps me slow down because I talk fast, but two, it also helps the patient kind of visually follow the steps of what I'm saying. But I usually give them a little tree algorithm. Okay, this is your local things. We're treating it at the local level, which means we're treating your breast and your armpit or your lymph nodes. And I have pictures. And then I say, these are your system things. They're treating your system, is treating your head to toe. That is stuff that we need. So I say, you know, these are usually a part of the treatments. What are you a candidate for? I circle those ones that they're a candidate for. Sometimes we go to chemotherapy first, for example, and it's for particular reasons. Let's say someone has a large mass, and that's really all that the problem is. There's no real evidence that cancer is anywhere else, but they really have a smaller breast size, and that mass is taking up majority of their breast, but they want me to do a breast conserving surgery, which means that they want me to preserve their breasts. And so sometimes that large mass won't let me do that, but if we give somebody chemo, we can sometimes shrink it down to a smaller size, which would allow me the potential or the opportunity to do that for that patient. That's one way sometimes we go to chemo first. Other times is if, you know, lymph nodes are involved or a type of cancer such as one that's not hormonally sensitive, for example. Sometimes they are better benefited with chemo first. We found that in research and studies that when they do chemo first and then I bring them back to surgery, that there's a good response rate, roughly 60% around there, that people who've had chemo first in the setting of hormone negative cancer can have actually a complete response to that chemo, which is actually a benefit to that patient. So there's different times we have those kind of conversations there are times where yes, surgery does not happen at all as well, but it's always difficult conversations sometimes.
You're a relatively new graduate with your lengthy education. Can you kind of tell us where we are? I know there's been a lot of advancements, but with our high mortality rate in Louisiana, is I guess two things, Dr. Grisby. It seems like medicine has advanced so much, but yet you have to go to get the treatment for the medicine to help you. So where are we, and like how would you compare where we are today to maybe where we were 30 or 40 years ago? Like, you know, if you can touch on that.
So definitely have made tremendous strides in the management and care and treatment of breast cancer. 30 years ago, I would tell you, we were probably doing a lot more aggressive surgery, which caused a more disfiguring outcomes for women and even men who are dealing with breast cancer. We would take the muscle that was underlying the breast tissue, which is your chest muscle, your pectoralis muscle, and that would cause the ribs to be, we disfigured people quite a bit because we thought we really need to get all this out. We really need to remove it surgically. But when we advanced to using things like radiation, when we've advanced to using, you know, more of our biology now, we know a little bit more about the tumor biology. We've developed other ways to treat these cancers and can limit some of that surgical morbidity or disfigurement or long-term problems that exist after surgery. And so we've gone from the whole mastectomy radical where we've taken the muscles and everything else underneath to just either just taking the breast tissue, sampling lymph nodes, which we've learned from the melanoma world, actually, that we can actually map a lymph node and how the body drains, like an infection. And we learned that actually from melanomas. And then we've segued that over to breast. And now we, that's where the whole biopsy or sentinel lymph node biopsy came from, actually. And so then now we do less surgery in the axilla and armpit, because what we found is that I tell people, let's say you get a cut on your hand and you need to clear the infection clears back up the arm this direction. So if we take two lymph nodes, we don't affect the highway too much. But if you cut a whole 10 or 20 out, you just created a big gap in that highway. So how does it get back there? It doesn't. It causes swelling and backup. And
Oh my gosh.
We learned that that was actually not a good thing, because once somebody develops that, if they have that and they develop it early, for example, and they have it for a certain period of time, that can also increase your risk for a secondary cancer of that arm, or, you know, it's called the angiosarcoma. So there's always a catch 22. And that's kind of what I tell people. We're going to try to treat something, but we can potentially cause another issue down the line, potential, right? That's really, but the risk of that is now less than it used to be because we don't do as much. So that's kind of how that process goes. But essentially, like, you're right, like we made advancements in chemotherapies. I mean, people with metastatic disease, which means people have had cancer somewhere outside of the breast, bone, brain, things like that, have actually survived much longer because of the advancements in some of the chemotherapy drugs, or not even chemotherapy drugs. It could be a pill that's a chemotherapy treating the system that people can take, but it has done a really good job of prolonging life, and people can go 5, 10 years, you know, years with cancer outside of the breast. But I think what you're alluding to too is, you know, when access to care or knowledge of the access to care, you know, I find that's also part of the problem. I think access to care is part of it, but it's also knowing, being educated about things. And so that's one of my biggest things. That, like, last year, I did a lot of education out into the smaller communities outside, because I realized I work at University Hospital as well. So
I was wondering about that. Yeah.
That is where I think I see quite, we do a lot of evaluations of numbers and what things look like stage for stage compared to other cancer centers and things. And we find, unfortunately, cancers at a later stage at University Hospital. And again, I think that it alludes to access to care, ability to pay for treatment, so, or even ability to take time off from work, so socioeconomic status. There's a lot of unfortunate variables that exist.
Well, they're not getting mammograms. They're not probably taking preventative measures because, like you said, their life circumstances don't really open that
door. One day off is a problem. One day off for them, they can't pay a life bill. One day they don't go to work. You know, so that's just, it's a different, you know, so I think the other part of this is bringing those mammograms to them. And I think that's our next phase. Of course, COVID kind of puts dampers on how we do these things. But I would love for us to try to figure out how to get to some of these communities and try to get some of these mammograms done. But my biggest point I tell people is, well, what happens after a screening mammogram is done. Let's say a screening mammogram is done in the community. We do all our, you know, mobile mammography, get out there. They get their mammogram done for free, but then they need additional workup. And then how does that process work for them? And that's the other part. I think we've done a good job of trying to get out there to do the screening. But what about the financial support of the rest of that process for someone who actually has something that needs to be done?
Yeah. Or prevent something from occurring, you know, down the line. Yeah.
Correct.
When is it recommended that we get mammograms when we start?
So I often tell people the standard time for most of us is going to be about 40 years of age. However, if you have a family member, a mom, a sister, a daughter, for example, somewhere in the first degree relative area that has had a cancer at, say, 40, then we usually recommend that you start your mammograms 10 years before, which would be 30. But you don't want to get a mammogram before age 30. Not that you can't, it's just that the breast tissue is always in a much more developmental state, and it's difficult to read a mammogram in a younger patient. So let's say somebody got diagnosed at 35 in the family. Like someone's mom's diagnosed at 35, someone's coming in to talk to me about when do I get screening. For that person, we don't start mammograms at 25. We might start an MRI or something like that at 25. And then the mammograms would not start until 30, though. You know, so it's still 10 years before, but not before age 30. So the standard time for an average risk person is 40.
I wish y'all had some magic wand where you could just wave it. That is the most uncomfortable thing. And I've had to go back for follow-ups, and I'm wondering, it's going to take a woman to invent some scan thing where you can just be there, like going through an airport, and just kind of get scanned. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Who developed that?
It is one. Yeah. I'm going to have to work on that one, you know, but yeah, I do agree. It's not the most comfortable exam in the world, unfortunately.
And I know it's necessary, but I have a friend, I'm just going to share. It's kind of funny. This friend of mine in Baton Rouge, that she had an associate at work and she was getting a mammogram and the lights went out in the facility. And so of course she's in the middle of the squish stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, it all worked out, but
yeah.
That had to be a man that came up with that. And I don't mean any disrespect, but there's got to be some way to improve this. And there will be, right? You're going to invent that.
Oh, yeah. Work in progress. I'm always thinking of how can we can make the experience better.
Yeah.
It's definitely, I have to just like, man, I think I got bruised just from the mammogram.
I know. Well, I'm curious about how COVID has affected your patients. I know that with the shutdown and surgeries, it wasn't just elective surgeries. There were many surgeries that were postponed. Has that affected your ability in this year? Has it affected your ability to treat your patients that needed surgical intervention?
Yes. So it did have an effect on how we went about treating things. So essentially what was happening is because we had made so much advancements in the treatment of breast cancer, the societies would say, okay, well, if someone has an early stage cancer of the breast, theoretically we could put them on a hormone pill if it was hormone sensitive and stave off usually the growth or the progression of a cancer ideally. And so that segued into us using that particular approach more frequently than we normally would. and then we would follow that up with a, you know, follow-up imaging to make sure things haven't progressed in clinical exams. And that's the issue, is clinical exams were still needed to happen in case something changed. If it was something that was felt before and then we put them on a therapy, we needed to still do clinical exams. So then at the time you're trying to figure out, you can't do telemedicine. And we were telemedicine talks and things were going on. And do we do this? Do we do that? And how do we, and so that became very difficult to try to figure out who really needed to be seen physically, who we could kind of see on video, and the video things for some of these patients was very difficult. You know, we do have a vast range of patients in age and their technical abilities. And so that also became a factor, but yes, it definitely changed some of the dynamics of how we did things during that time. It led to some research studies to happen in the breast world, as far as what if we do this first, this happened, can we do these things and see what those results look like. So they have been doing a registry for, we call it a COVID registry, because people were treated a certain way that was outside of our normal treatment. It definitely affected that. And I think really it was more of a scarier time for the patients, because while we as doctors know they'll be okay, that you can't be, you can't really convince, I wouldn't, if I was not knowledgeable about it, you wouldn't convince me that I was going to be okay. You're sitting here with this, you know, with this cancer. So that became a, you know, reassuring patients that they're going to be okay, that things hadn't progressed. And most, and truthfully, most patients were really aware of that and understood it, but I'm sure in the back of their mind, they're like,
why me?
You don't want to do, I can't do anything. Like, you want me to sit here with, you know, it's like, it's going to be okay. Cause we know these cancers usually grow slow. And then those cancers that were a little bit more aggressive, then we said, okay, well, they would probably get chemo anyway. So let's give them chemo first. Right. So, but then the questions that come up are, well, if I'm on chemo, am I more susceptible to getting COVID? It was just like, I'm gonna get COVID if I'm on chemo. Cause now I'm immunocompromised and this and that. And truth be told, our Cancer Center of Acadiana did a great job of making sure that the risk to those patients was really low. I think we, you know, we made sure that everybody was spread out. I mean, I think when you look at the stats of COVID and the cancer patients who got COVID, it's not, they're not the, they were in there, but they're not the highest peak of the ones getting the coronavirus. So I think we did, the world has done a pretty good job of making sure that those patients who were going to be immunocompromised in that way were able to be safe. And so we couldn't even put, so when we do chemo, we usually put a little port in to kind of protect. We weren't even able to do that. So people had to go and get these little PICC lines. It was a different time. And I'm glad we're kind of somewhat back to normalcy, although obviously we're still aware of the concern for, you know, contraction as the numbers kind of keep going like this. And so it's always a risky thing. And
right. Here we are.
Our patients as best we can, wiping things, you know, washing our hands, keeping our, you know, face mask on and all those things. So
right. I want to get into the lifestyle and ways we can prevent cancer. But as we do that, Dr. Grisby, I'm curious, I was thinking about the breast cancer gene. Do you test for that? Do most of your patients have that genetic predisposition? Like I have so many friends that have had breast cancer, and unfortunately, many of them, it's spread.
Yeah.
And sometimes they've been cured. I'm using that air quote thing, which I hate. Mm-hmm. And then the cancer reemerges in another form years down the line. But do most of your patients, are you finding that they have that breast cancer gene?
And truthfully, most people don't actually have the gene. But we do, here we have a pretty organized high risk assessment that goes on during someone with a diagnosis of cancer, but also for individuals who may have family histories or concerning, you know, think it's going to be assessed to see where the risk lies. And so we do we have a high risk program that we started here that we take on that role to kind of screen and see what people are, see who needs additional screening imaging, who meets the criteria for genetic testing. And truthfully, you know, it's a smaller percentage of the population that actually has that gene mutation or that breast-related cancer gene or BRCA 1 or 2, but there are actually other genes that exist. And so that's kind of where the biggest issue lies, is making sure that patients are aware of the other genes that could potentially lead to increased risk for breast cancer, but not just breast cancer. You're talking about ovarian cancer and uterine cancer, stomach cancer, pancreas, I mean, any cancer. So I usually do a detailed history, and I like to know the other cancers that people have, because those are also risk factors for needing genetic assessment beyond just the breast related genes, right? The breast BRCA gene that everybody knows. So yes, I do screen every patient for those risk factors, for the necessity for genetic testing. And, you know, we make sure that if they meet the criteria, if they have those risk factors, that we talk about it, we discuss it. Some people don't want to know, and that's okay. But other people want to know and get tested more so for their families, if they have children or other family members who are concerned. But truthfully, you'll find that unfortunately, most people do not have that genetic mutation, and they are in that average risk of people who just decide that 12%, that 12.5% risk. The average risk is 12.5% for someone in the community without any other issues. But family history is still a factor, even if you're not genetically mutated. Maybe there's a gene we just haven't found yet. I don't know. But I would say that it isn't part of the assessment process. And there are people with family histories, but unfortunately there are people, most of the people are getting cancer without that mutations.
So lifestyle choices, you know, what I read, it's cut back on alcohol, have a clean diet. What is the best and highest things we can do, like choices we can make? Because we're the ones that can take charge of our body. Even if we end up with a cancer, if we do everything we can to take care of ourselves, mm-hmm. at least you don't have regrets. You know, what do you recommend when you go out into the community? What do you recommend that people look at in their lives that they could?
So having a well-balanced diet is definitely important. I think that is the one thing you kind of want to have you have your carbs, you have your proteins, you have your fat, and they all need to be in diet in a certain modification. Protein and vegetables are very important. I preach that. And obviously you need healthy carbs. So not your starchy carbs, but maybe your more veggie carbs that actually have carbohydrates in it. And then your healthy fats. So not cooking with, you know, chicken grease per se, but, you know, your olive oils and your avocado oils and things like that are a little bit more of a fat content. And so I try to teach all that healthy diet, nutrition support. We have a good nutrition support at the Cancer Center of Acadiana, and as well as our radiation groups. And so we try to make sure that people are aware of that. I'm pretty well versed at diet and modifications myself, so I try to help them through that process. I always encourage exercise, even if just walking, stay up, take the stairs. There's still little things they can do throughout the day to still be active, unfortunately, in the setting of COVID. But if they're outside, walk the trails outside. And obviously, unfortunately, we've had a lot of rain and weather issues and problems. And so that really makes it a big deal. But I just hope people take some laps around your kitchen islands and around your house and just kind of walk back and forth throughout the house. You really want to try to stay as active as possible, at least 3 to 5 days a week, 30-minute exercise spans, which is tough for some people. And it became much tougher during Corona, I can tell you. And then obviously, yes, alcohol limitation, try not to drink several glasses of alcohol a day. I mean, obviously if you have a glass of wine, it is what it is. I don't try to really kibosh that too much. But yes, there is a relative association with the amount of alcohol drinks that, and so the more you drink, obviously the higher the risk, because I think there is some estrogens that can be produced from that process. And so that can increase somebody's risk. And then really it's just prevention, maintaining your screening mammograms. I recommend them annually. I know there's some screening guidelines out there that exist that say every 2 years. Most of the breast surgery world don't really follow that. We tend to follow the yearly screening recommendations, because we who do breast on a regular basis, we see that there's cancers that can evolve within the year or within that 6 month span. And so I usually don't recommend waiting 2 years in between. And obviously if you're a little bit older, but again, you know, even being older does not mean that you can't get a progression of cancer in the short period of time either. And so that is just usually what I put out there. And then just knowing your family history, I always say the biggest part of also prevention is knowing where you came from. So yeah, I know there was a dictum back in the time where people didn't really discuss their health issues with family members, but I think it's very important now as we recognize that yes, there are some genetic predispositions and higher risk things of screenings. And so even if they aren't, even if they don't have an inherited mutation, they may still meet criteria for additional screening studies such as MRIs and things to be a part of their screening. So that way, if God forbid they did develop a breast cancer of some kind, we would find it at the most early stage that we can find it. And that's just really part of that prevention or early detection that I put out there.
What about hormone replacement therapy? You know, that's such a big thing. And with that, the bioidentical, I don't know if there's any difference in what it does to your body, but what are your recommendations on that? Because that can cause an increased risk of breast cancer, right?
Right.
That's good, but then it can cause risk for other things.
Yeah, right. So essentially, you know, there's a lot of research going on with that right now. And if it's estrogen or progesterone or what have you, that works better. And I think we're kind of finding that estrogen is actually not really the bad culprit, of course, more so compared to progesterone. But again, really, I tell people you only want to be on it as long as you need to be on it and get off it as quickly as you need to get off it. Like, I think what happened is that people just left people on it and they were just on it for years. And I'm like, do you know if you even need it? You know? And so I said, why don't you just try seeing how you do without it? But obviously, you know, I said, your body should now kind of be adjusted to that hormonal change that has existed. So let's see how you do. If you really feel like you're not doing well, then okay, we can put you back on the smallest minute dose that we can. And so it's always kind of, you know, worthwhile to have that kind of conversation and see what people are and why they're on it, what happened, how long they've been on it. And we assess all that. And like you said, the other options that exist out there, I think they're, you know, comparable, but my ultimate goal is to try to get people off them if they don't need it. And have them only on it for the time period that is necessary. And so the shorter the time, the better. And that's kind of how I.
Right. Any other advice? Have I asked you what you expected? Are there any other things you'd like to share about your role, you know, in breast cancer awareness? Anything that we didn't touch on?
I think we hit on quite a good amount of salient points. And I just think that everybody just needs to all, and I think the one thing I leave is when COVID exists, we get out and these hurricanes have existed and there's a lot of life things going on. Don't neglect yourself because it could lead to that downstream issue of finding a cancer too late. And then now you're not only dealing with the hurricane and this, but now you're dealing with the fact that you can't even help with it because either you have cancer in your bones or what have you. So it takes a short period of time to get the screening mammogram. Just, you got to still make it a priority.
Yeah, that's inspirational. I have a paper. I'm supposed to go get a mammogram, and it's been like 2 or 3 years, maybe 2 years. And it's so easy to put things off, and we can
very easy.
Really, this year has flown by for most of us. It's
yes.
In a bubble, don't you think?
People yes.
Just putting off all kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess some people be careful with doing that just because things can happen and you don't want to get to a point where we can't do anything about it.
Right.
And then all those life things that you're worried about become not so important once we find out something's serious is going on. So that's just.
Right. Dr. Shawna Grisby, we're lucky to have you here. I wish people could, I'm going to have a picture of your beautiful face on my website, and we'll be promoting this through social media, but I wish people could see you right now, your heart, like you're passionate about what you do. And that's what we all want in our doctors, you know, to know that you care. So thank you.
Absolutely. And I always tell the patients I put you first. I'm giving you suggestions and recommendations, but it's your body. And so I often tell people who don't always do the recommended things that it's okay. I'd much rather them still follow and see me. We've got a lot of the holistic approaches to medicine. I'm completely okay with those things. I don't like people to go get lost and think that I don't support what they want. And so that's the main thing I also tell my patients. Like if you're not agreeing, I'm just going to make sure that you understand the risk that you're taking, but understand if there's a problem, I'm here. I'm not like, this is not like me dismissing you because you don't want to do what I say. Like, that's not how this works. It's a team approach. This is not me. This is us. And so that's usually my approach to discussions.
Right. Right. That's comforting to know that. Well, thank you for joining us. And I'd like to thank Ochsner Lafayette General for encouraging me to reach out to you. They're a sponsor of our show, as you know. And breast cancer awareness. I'm hoping that this interview will maybe touch one heart that hasn't, somebody that hasn't taken care of themselves. Maybe they'll go and get that mammogram and get some follow-up treatment if they need it. And I'd like to thank our other sponsors. Of course, Iberia Bank is now First Horizon, mm-hmm. and Raider, which makes our show possible. And I'd like to thank our listeners. You can find Dr. Shawna Grisby's interview and over 175 others at discoverlafayette.net. You can also subscribe to Discover Lafayette on your device, on your phone, your pad, whatever, and have this delivered every Friday to your device. We encourage you to share this with the community. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, this is Jan Swift. Thank you.